Recording. And boom. Alrighty, good evening, everybody. It is Wednesday, October 5th. 2022. It's 8:02 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time. This is the Fakeologist speaking. This is the Fakeologist show. I do this show Sunday through Thursdays, usually start at 8. Yesterday, I did not show up because Uncle Vigilante took the day off, and so did I. And there's so much audio on my site that is newly created that I thought maybe you could scroll onto the site, check out our audio chats. And the thing is, if I do a show every night, the problem with that is I don't have time to do any research or book any guests. But this is the other problem when you do a show in the evening and you work full time like I do. But tonight I found a guest on one of the shows that I really, really enjoy. And you're going to like tonight. I'm going to go into my family tree a bit and do some lamenting about history in the past. Without further ado, I think that's an Irish term. Without further ado, maybe it's English. I'm going to say hello to my special guest, Chris Fogarty. I believe he's from Chicago, Illinois. Hello, Chris.
Hello, can you hear me?
Oh, fantastic. Thankfully, you're one of the smart ones that has a proper microphone. I am so grateful for all guests that are sounding good.
Yes, I was raised in Ireland, and in school there, we were all taught famine. We weren't taught potato famine because that's going a bit too far. But famine, we were taught famine, and we weren't told why it happened. And there was no mention whatever made of the British Army, and I knew nothing whatever about any British Army involvement my whole life.
Yeah.
Until Cecil Woodham Smith, an Anglo-Irish writer, wrote a book in which he named 13 British regiments.
Yeah.
And the resistance they met while seizing the food and exporting it. But then she buried that under so many other contradictory statements that upon reading the book, I was still left with the label that I accepted of famine.
All right. Hey, Chris, you're going too fast for my audience. We're a little slow here. First, I want to just say that you are Chris Fogarty. And if I looked at your website, which is called, IrishHolocaust.org, when I looked at the about, I did some quick math, and you appear to be 87 years old. Is that possible?
Yes, I was 87 yesterday.
Oh, my goodness. Happy birthday, because you are the oldest guest I've ever had on my podcast. So congratulations.
Thank you. My father was 10 and a half years older than me before he died.
Wow. That's amazing. So hats off to you, sir. I saw you on the video with Matt Arrett of Canadian Patriot. I'm a huge fan of Matt. I think he's one of the smartest historical minds to ever come out of Canada. And
I've learned to believe that too, yes.
I don't know where he comes from or who's funding him, because there's always a story behind a story. But I've always been interested in the Irish Holocaust, mainly A, because half my family tree is from County Cork, and I don't know a lot about my history other than the fact that my great-grandfather, I believe, was the one that came over on whatever boat that was, and he ended up in Quebec. And when I heard you talking on Matt Arrett's show the other day, and by the way, I put that on my own video platform, Chris, called FakoTube, and already it's got over 6,000 views on FakoTube. I just put up yesterday.
Wow.
So I don't know where. Somebody must have posted it somewhere to get this attention, because I usually only get 2,000 to 3,000 views of my show and on the first couple days. So you're getting 6,000 I don't know how many Matt is getting. As a matter of fact, let me just click on this right now, real quick. And then I'll click on the source, which is YouTube. And he's only at 600 views on his YouTube site. And by the way, I have to say goodbye to the YouTube audience tonight, because just in case we say anything controversial, YouTubers are YouTube censors like crazy. So I'm going to say goodbye to YouTube right now. And if you want to listen to the rest of this show, you have to go to fakeotube.com. So I was so excited, and Chris was so excited, I almost forgot my the things I have to do at the beginning. So goodbye, YouTube. Come to fakeotube if you want to watch the rest of this. Okay, good. Now I can talk about viruses and vaccines with abandon without worrying about being kiboshed. So I just put a picture of your face up there on the screen there. So you're 87th. Like, I have a lot of respect for my elders, and I really take my hat off to you. You're using technology, and you're still doing this, and you sound and look great for your age. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. By the way, maybe you know this already, but your last name, Flood, in Irish is McTully or Tully. And Tully is a fairly common name actually around County Galway. There were mm-hmm. Kellys directly across the Castletore River from where my mother was born and where I lived for a while. So Tully is Irish for Flood.
Well, my grandfather drank Tullamore Dew. Does that have anything to do with it?
Actually, that Tulla is not Tully. That Tulla is a hill, and Tullamore is a big hill. It's in County, Tullamore is in County Offaly. I know it well, but a different root word.
Okay, because I don't know any. I've never been out of North America before. This was the last couple of years is when I was going to start traveling and seeing the world, and I was definitely going to hit Ireland to see my roots in England. And of course, we know what happened a couple of years ago. We've been grounded, and I don't even know if I'll ever get off the island to go to that island. So that's my mother's side there. So she, as a matter of fact, my mother's the only one that did the family tree, mm-hmm. and that's how I know how deep the roots go. But our family, I'm guessing, was given a tract of land just outside on the Ottawa River in Campbell's Bay, which is in Quebec there. It's the English part, I guess, Irish part of Quebec. So I was really interested to hear when you talked about how the Irish had French names, because a lot of orphans came over here. So the whole story is fascinating. So I'm going to let you do more talking. I just wanted to introduce you properly and say hi. And the whole point of this conversation is I wanted to talk about the Irish potato famine, because I figured that was a hoax. As a fakeologist, almost everything that we're told, I've found out, is a hoax or a lie or cheating. So that's why I'm fascinated by this story. And I haven't heard anyone talk about it as well as you have. So I'm really grateful, and because I wanted to get you on before too much time passes because of your advanced age. I figured I'm not going to wait for this guy next year. I got to get him on now because he's very... very well spoken, and I really enjoyed the interview, and I know you could talk for the whole hour. So how did you get into this? How did you get interested quickly?
I was interested ever since 1946, when my mother used to describe a piece across the river in the bog that used to be a gathering place for the evicted people, evicted by the English landlords at the time.
Right.
And how some of them didn't survive over there, but others, then the land was, the British government split up all those big English estates in Ireland and divided them among the cultivators. So the Irish, after centuries, were allowed to reap the products of their own work. They were essentially enslaved before that. It wasn't entirely slavery for the last couple of hundred years, but before that, it was out-and-out slavery. That is to say, the people did not have legal personhood. So you could do what you would with any Irish person. That is to say, any English person in Ireland could do what they wanted with any Irish person, because having no legal personhood, they had absolutely no recourse to the law. The law did exist to punish them, but not to protect them. They were not legal persons. So that's the start of it, and that continued under Queen Elizabeth I and Cromwell. But by the time of the Holocaust, they were persons, and the land. And in 1900, 1910, the British government bought out its English landlords of Ireland at above market prices, but compulsorily. They could not refuse. So they were all bought out, and the land was split up and into little holdings, survival holdings, where the Irish then were able to reap the benefit of their work from then on, except that there was a rent to be paid. So starting the amount given to the English landlords for land that they had never bought was such a huge amount that payback period, the amortization period, was set at 68.5 years. Mm-hmm. So for years after I left Ireland, my parents were still paying that rent into the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And maybe as far as 1980, but it ended then. They was paid off then. But that's how that one worked. But to start off with, why the Irish died is that the British government sent in more than half of its entire army. Its entire empire army at the time was 126 regiments. 67 of those were sent into Ireland, where their main mission was a seizing of Irish agricultural production and escorting it to the ports for export. Mm-hmm. And the people started dying of starvation from having been robbed of their own food crops. It was done for the benefit of the English landlords in Ireland at the time, who typically had 20 or 30,000 acres that they had never bought or paid for.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the basic situation. So today, the map of Ireland is dotted, as you can see, with little red crosses, which I show. And that's under 10% of the total number of mass graves in Ireland from those years. There had been two previous Holocausts, but this one was in 1845, 1850. And so,
Why is it called a Holocaust? I always thought that was a burning. That's what's been seared into my mind. So where did the word Holocaust come from?
Well, you're quite right about burning part of it. It's their Greek words, holo, in entirety, and cost, C-A-U-S-T, a burning.
Okay.
So to be burnt in its entirety as a sacrifice, a religious sacrifice. They would kill sheep, etc. Usually to offset their vengeance, their angry gods and sacrifice a sheep instead of trying to save some humans. I think that was the idea behind it originally.
Mm-hmm.
But it was applied to Ireland because it was applied to Ireland in writing by, for example, Michael Davitt at the time during the 1840s. And this is important. It was reported in the Cork, now it's the Irish Examiner newspaper. It was at the time the Cork Examiner newspaper, County Cork. It was reported starting on May 4, 1846 and continuing until 19th of November, 1855, conditions in Ireland were reported as Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, in matters of labels, of historic events, it seems, and I think it's accepted, that precedent usage has some merit. And so there might be others who have used it. It had to be taken from the Bible. It exists from the Bible. And so there was no word in existence in either English or Irish that could describe what was going on, the destruction of the entire people by starvation, by removing all the food, that they reached evidently to the Bible and used Holocaust out of it. And so that applies to Ireland more than any other nation. Genocide was coined by Raphael Lemkin, a Polish Jew, in post-World War II, in his effort to persuade the U.S. Congress about what the Germans had done to the Jews exclusively.
Okay.
And so genocide, even though it has become now the generic term for this kind of an event, it was coined to persuade the U.S. Congress about what was done to the Jews.
Right.
In Irish, there is a word that was used at the time in Irish, and it's R-A-R, A with a father or a stroke over it, Antar Mór, the great Holocaust, genocide, Holodomor. Mm-hmm. There's no other. So Antar Mór in Irish, but again, Holocaust in English. And again, I would never dream of imposing a label that I would fabricate, because mm-hmm. this is far too important. This comes from the actual time while it was being imposed by the British government.
Okay, I gotcha.
By the way, on the subject of Holocaust, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with a book written by the son of Yehuda Menuhin, the great Israeli violinist, internationally famous 50 years ago, brilliant. His son, Gerard Menuhin, has written a book entitled Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil.
Okay.
And it uses documents from the Nazi era and from Red Cross and other international organizations. And it seems that, and I'm not going to get into this, but it completely demolishes the whole Jewish Holocaust story.
Right. Well, it wouldn't be the first book to change the story. And I don't even know if legally you can even say that in Canada anymore, because they're passing laws about what you can and can't say. So anything that minimizes the official story apparently is possibly in the criminal code of Canada. I don't know, but something happened this year. So I like to say that whatever the official story is of anything is suspect. From 9/11 to JFK to the moon landing to the Irish potato famine. So I've done some research on what they call revisionism, and suffice it to say, I think the German people suffered quite a genocide / Holocaust after the war officially ended. So that is another mass killing that really. It's another story that most people have never been told and never researched. And the ones that do try and tell it, like Ert Zundel, found himself in trouble in Canada, and then he was tried in Germany for just basically trying to defend the German people's honor. And he died, I guess, impoverished as well from all his fighting. I always wonder people that end up telling the truth, they're fighting for the truth, and they get absolutely nowhere, and they always die with nothing. I just heard that Tim Ball, who's telling the truth or had told the truth about climate change, man-made climate change, is a hoax. He died penniless a couple days ago. And again, he's got the truth on his side, but it doesn't seem to matter. That's why I find people like you super brave, because there's no upside to your story, to telling your story, other than it's the truth, as you know it.
I didn't mention this, I think, on the Eret show, but now that you're bringing this up of our penalties against truth tellers, is that my main work is actually this one single cover-up, the cover-up of this single genocide in Ireland.
Yes.
We also did a little bit of political. Once I found that out over in the British Public Records Office at the time, now that's called the National Archives, once I found that out, I put out a pamphlet. And then because of this new information, I started looking at conditions in the occupied six counties of Ireland.
Okay.
I had essentially taken the British side at that until then. So I started looking at that more carefully, and I found out that's the same old genocide that's still continuing vestigially against the Irish by the British. And so we got a law enacted in the state of Illinois, and later in the federal government, which require U.S. companies who have pension funds invested in them. These are big companies like Ford Motor and IBM, etc., who are operating in the Ireland six counties, to not participate in the British policy of job denial against the Irish.
Heard of that. Is that in 2022 the British can deny allowing people of Ireland, or
yes, in the part that they occupy. They occupy the six northeastern counties, six of the counties of nine counties of Ulster, of the province of Ulster of Ireland. They occupy six of those counties.
I'm looking at the map now. What are they? Armagh, Tyrone,
all the counties around that lake.
Oh, this lake here.
Yeah, all the counties. There are five around the lake, and then one more, Fermanagh. So to the there, right in there is Fermanagh.
Oh, here,
so
yeah.
Those six counties all together are occupied and operated by the British government.
That's the Northern Ireland, right?
That's so-called Northern Ireland, yes.
Okay, I gotcha.
Northernmost Ireland is in Donegal, up at the top. That's the Republic of, that's not Northern Ireland, even though it goes all the way up to the top there. The northernmost point is in the Republic, the northernmost point.
Right.
Anyways, the Irish were not allowed to vote, in the land of their ancestors. They had no vote. You had to be a property owner, and they had long since been robbed of their property. And so in 1968, the people there started lobbying and campaigning for the vote. They were bloodily suppressed by the police and by the army and by the English in Northern Ireland, or the British in Northern Ireland. But in 1973, they were granted the vote for the first time in centuries. And so the British government responded by calling upon all employers there to cease hiring Catholics, is the word they used, because Catholic and Irish there is almost synonymous.
All right.
And so once we in the States learned that, we decided we would at least get the United States companies to not participate in that. In those years, 25 U.S. corporations employed 11% of the working population of those six counties. And if we could get them at least to not participate, it would help. So we did that. We got it enacted in the state of Illinois here, nationwide in Washington D.C. And it probably helped some. In any event, what all this is leading up to is, I don't know whether it was the work I've done on the Holocaust or the other subsequent political work, but the FBI framed me for the murder of a family I'd never heard of.
Wow! I heard that. I couldn't believe it.
Well, you have heard. I see.
Yeah, I heard you on the show say it somewhere. I might have heard another show that you did, but yeah, I heard you say that. Go ahead, keep going. This is fascinating and scary.
I was doomed if the murderer did not blab through his FBI cover. He's now serving life without possibility of parole. He was 16 when, using FBI agent Lewis's .357 Magnum, he murdered that couple and their unborn child. He's serving, again, life without possibility of parole in downstate Illinois Pontiac Prison for two first-degree murders and a homicide of the child and breaking, entering, etc. No mention of the FBI's gun that he used, however. That does not come up at all in the crimes.
So they just took a random case and tried to slap it on you?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
In fact, the local police had already named the murderer as their sole suspect when the FBI arrived on scene, usurped all investigatory authority, prohibited the police from investigating the murderer, and set them off on me, and then finally framed me for it in a way that I couldn't. They attributed words to me that nobody on earth could know except the murderer and the first investigators on the crime scene. So there was no way I could escape it. But I never even knew about it. They didn't arrest me at the time because the murderer was taking his high school friends on tours of the murder scene. And they didn't know if they could make this thing stick.
They
burst through our door. They burst through our door with five agents with drawn guns, burst through our door and brought us down and locked us up in the federal jail downtown Chicago at Clark and Van Buren streets and tried to imprison us for the rest of our lives.
You and who else? Your wife?
Me and my wife and two friends.
Oh my God.
Yes. And the two friends are now dead. I'm very sorry to say. I must say, being attacked by the FBI seems to be a life shortening experience. Mm-hmm. one of our friends died at 51 years of age. And the same FBI agent later was deployed into Ireland, but from Ireland he flew to the Atlanta Olympics bombing murder site, where he led the team that framed the security guard, Richard Jewell, for those bombing murders. If you can get to see the film that Clint Eastwood and Warner Brothers made of, entitled Richard Jewell, named for the security guard framed by the FBI agent, Patrick Buckley, you'll see that in that film, the evil FBI agent is called Pat, correctly in that film, because that evil FBI agent is the same FBI agent, Patrick Buckley, who burst through our doors here with drawn guns and locked us up and did all, and also framed me for the murders of the Langard people. But in Ireland, while in Ireland, he remained in Ireland, an MI5 FBI team remained in Ireland until the evening of 15 August 1998. In other words, when he finished up down at the Atlanta Olympics, in 1996, he went back to Ireland, where he was stationed for the FBI. And he, as an FBI agent, as a special agent FBI, he remained there until the evening of 15th of August, 1998, upon the murder of 29 people by an IRA bomb. That murder, that atrocity, defeated the IRA. That was mission accomplished in Ireland. And the mission was to defeat the IRA in order to free up the British Army, without which the full spectrum dominance plans of the neocons could not move forward. But with that freed up British Army, plans went ahead and the wars went ahead in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, etc. And so it was that atrocity in Ireland that it enabled all those wars to go ahead.
But what was that? Because I'm putting notes as you're talking. So I got Richard Jewell. I sort of remember that story a little bit. A lot of the stories that were told people died, we found are full of holes, and we attribute them to psychological operations, especially when we look at the numerology and the stories. This is one I haven't really looked into, but I find that most stories are very, very suspicious. So now you put this one on the map, and I know I have some fakeologists that are going to look into this story as well. So what was the one where 29 people died in Northern Ireland? What was that one?
That was where the...
Oh, what was it called?
It's in the town of Omagh, O-M-A-G-H, in County Tyrone, in the six occupied counties.
Was it called the Omagh bombing, or...
The Omagh bombing, O-M-A-G-H bombing,
okay.
Yes.
You look at that one too. Okay.
And that was a real IRA bomb. But that group of bombers, that was their sixth bombing. Before the arrival of MI5 and the FBI into their group as infiltrators, they had bombed the shop fronts of five towns and villages without the loss of a drop of blood. And it cost the British Exchequer millions of pounds to put new faces on all those shop fronts. So Omagh was their sixth bombing, but this is the one in which they were infiltrated by MI5 and the FBI from Chicago.
So you're saying that your FBI guy was related to this somehow?
Yes. His next job after we defeated him in federal court.
Okay. Was he also related to the Richard Jewell?
Yes. Yes. We wouldn't know that it was him down in Atlanta, but while giving testimony at a Dublin trial of an IRA man, David Rupert from upstate New York.
Yeah, I see the name here in Wikipedia, David Rupert. Okay.
Yes. Well, while testifying, he just blurted out, I was once left all alone in Ireland by my boss, FBI agent Buckley, when he flew to the Atlanta Olympics bombing. So we would not know it if we had not. And that might be the only truth that liar told in his 7 days on the witness stand.
So which one is the guy after you, Kevin Fulton?
Kevin Fulton, that was, no, that's over in Ireland. And I must say, he was a mole by the British within the Irish system. And that was completely separate from any crimes that were perpetrated against us before they went to Ireland.
Mm-hmm. But it was the guy, who was the guy that was after you? I just want to see if he's in this article here.
Well, Richard Jewell was after us.
Mm-hmm. No, who's the FBI guy?
Patrick Buckley. Patrick Buckley is the guy who committed. Okay. He was a single person who perpetrated or led all those crimes.
Oh, okay, because he's not mentioned in this. I'm getting confused because we got so many events spinning around in my head right now. So I've linked to these, and we'll have a look at them and see if they pass our fakeologist muster. I can tell you right now, there's a lot of numerology in this story too, but. You know, one of the things that I'm sure you know, or you probably are aware, is the British are the best at psychological operations. So they put on a lot of these events, and no one does it better. Whether or not actually people die is another story. So I just wanted to put that out there because I don't know how deep into media fakery and psyops you go into in your thing. And I've already had a couple members on my site ask, how do we know exactly how many people died in the Irish Holocaust as well? Because we're going way back. So what can you tell us about that?
In fact, I know only my area of knowledge is only quite small. The specific crimes perpetrated against us here in Chicago by FBI agent Buckley and 18 other FBI agents, and their use of him in Ireland immediately after, and then his trip from Ireland down to the Atlanta Olympics in 1996. That's about the extent of my knowledge about these things, and of course the Holocaust. And so that's all, and that is all a matter of, that's not a matter of opinion, or it's not a matter of my trying to prove something. Mm-hmm. I merely am presenting the same evidence that shocked me when I first saw it at the Public Record Office in London.
Oh, okay.
And the records are all there available for anyone. Mm-hmm. The deployment of the army, that's the name of the record, deployment of the army. And then there's, each year has its own set of records for all 120-some. The number of regiments changes from year to year. But the each year has its own set of documents. I possess true copies of the 6 years, 1845 through 1850. There's absolutely no doubt they were handwritten at the time in those years. Mm-hmm. And so this is beyond dispute. And where they were every day of that time is all a matter of record that is available to anyone who goes to the, now it's called the National Archives in Kew outside London. Or I have a true copy made by them at the then Public Record Office in my possession, and I'm working off a photocopy I made in order to not wear them out. So it took 67 British regiments to perpetrate that Holocaust. Mm-hmm. I noticed that those who want to deny it or want to diminish it or refute it or confuse it or obfuscate it, they immediately jump to, well, what's the exact number who were murdered?
Right.
And I have found that I'm not going to play that game, because that is the only number, that is the only figure that can never be precisely known.
Right. Yeah.
And it is because it cannot be precisely known that it introduces an element of cloudiness into all of the other precise figures in my possession.
Right. I gotcha.
And so again, it took 67 regiments just to starve millions of people.
What was the purpose? I know, I don't know if you've said this on the other show, but why did the British want to starve the Irish? So basically it is pre-planned genocide, because when you take away the food, people are going to die. That's pretty simple math. So what did they have against the Irish? Was it one of my theories is a lot of wars, if this could be called a war, is strategic demolition and controlled demolition and strategic relocation. So is it possible that the British are experts at moving populations around and they wanted to get the Irish over to North America, which is why I'm talking to you today, because people are not going to move if you just tell them to move. And if they want to keep the empire going and get Canada and America going, they need to move people around the empire? Well,
the longer picture tends to give a better view of a small component of it. Mm-hmm. Now, there were three genocides. The first one was under, well, that we know, well, there was another questionable one under the Norman Anglos in 1170.
Okay.
But in the, under Elizabeth and Cromwell, the all Irish were to be either executed on the spot or enslaved if they were found east of the Shannon River after May the 1st, 1654. Sorry, 1654. Okay. So if you look at the Shannon River, you see a line of lakes that run
right here.
Right up along there. Everything, all the Irish had to move to west of that river, the River Shannon.
Limerick and Clare, get over here, Galway.
Exactly, Mayo, Slough. Yeah, and so that was the first, as you point out, or suggest, the idea was the elimination of a people in order to occupy their land.
Right.
And so that was the obvious cause of this idea of executing everyone found east of the Shannon River. And in fact, as soon as they had the Irish living west of the Shannon, they divided that land up among themselves anyways, leaving the entire Irish people with no property whatever. So
right.
With no property, they had without legal personhood, they obviously had no property because they had no recourse. If anyone took their property, whatever anything they had no legal recourse.
Right. So the British wanted all these eastern counties to themselves.
Got that first, but then they took the whole island.
Well, why did they? So they just wanted to want to conquer Ireland for why? They have better farmland than they do in England?
In their own words, they just simply wanted to eliminate an inferior people replace them with a superior people.
Right, okay. Well, it's a form of eugenics.
Yes.
Well,
yeah.
What? I don't know. I obviously I'm half Irish, or that's a part of my heritage. What's the difference between an English person and an Irish person, just to look at them? Is there any physical difference?
Not that I know of.
Because I've heard that the English think that the Irish have big heads, or there's something about their head that looks more from the past. Or how do you tell an Irishman from an Englishman? Really, that's my question. They're both white.
For centuries, you could tell them because the Irish were in rags and the English weren't.
Right.
So it was by the appearance.
Yeah, just socioeconomically, the Irish had less money.
Yes.
So
yes.
Other than that, there's no real physical difference between Irish and English.
No, not that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
However, even in the States at the time, you'll find way along in that book, an American writer points out the difference between the English in Ireland and the Irish in Ireland. And one face is a dowdy, much older woman with a pug nose and creases in her face, and the other beautiful young woman of 20 years of age is the English woman. And so these two are shown side by side as the evidence of the moral superiority of the English compared to the Irish. And so that they operated in that way. It's the kind of thing that is attributed to the Nazis today.
Right. Yeah, the Nazis. Like, I think the same old people have been running the world for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. A lot of people think it's the Phoenicians, the Venetians, and they just moved from Venice to Amsterdam to London, and they're the same people running the place today. And they are eugenicists. They are constantly trying to implement a eugenics program, and they think they're better than God, and they want to sort out the whole world. And it does make sense that they've manifested in the British Empire for the last couple hundred years, because has there been a more successful empire in the last couple hundred years that you can think of?
No, there has not been.
Right.
No.
So it's the same old people that are running the show. They've got all the money. They control the banking. They control psychological operations. And now they're in the process of trying to take over the entire world. And so far, I think they're winning.
Yes, that's where we are. There's Tony Chaitkin. Do you know the name Anton Chaitkin?
I've heard of it.
I have a copy here in my hand, Who We Are, Volume 1, 1750s to 1850s.
Okay, let me find this one. I'll look it up here. Who We Are. Who We Are. Anton Chaitkin?
Yes, Chaitkin.
Okay, let's see if it's on. Yeah, here. Wait, no, it's not on. This is a PDF book site here. So that one's not there. Let me see.
Well, this is available on Amazon, so it's out there, and I have a copy of it. But it is truly, truly brilliant. And he gives me hope that if his book could be read by the American people, it would get out of the pit it's in and begin to save itself. Because the conditions you're describing came to a clash in the 1820s and 30s. And the American system prevailed. That's him right there, Anton Chaitkin. And the American system prevailed at that time, except for the elimination of slavery. And it was the slavery group, along with the British, and along with a number of families in New England, that created the entire anti-American system. And Chaitkin points out that the murder of Kennedy might have been the main victory for the British in America, for the tough totalitarians in America. That was a key moment in American history, from which I won't put words in his mouth, from which there might not be a comeback. But everyone is wondering now.
Okay. So I'm going to put a link to this book as well. So you're giving me lots of things to look up. And Anton Chaitkin is the author. And let me find the book here, Who We Are.
Yes. And by the way, I think it's largely from Anton Chaitkin that Matt Everett got much of his earlier learning, his training.
Maybe. Yeah, I know. Well, Matt's very well read. And, you know, if I had a history teacher like him in school, I would have taken history. I would have been a history major, because it's so fascinating, the psyops and the British Empire and how these guys have managed to build the empire and just stay sort of hidden behind the scenes, put all kinds of front men in front for us to get excited about. It's just fascinating how good these guys are. And
yes.
And they're doing it today still. It's amazing. Yes.
But it's also maybe important here to show a bit more about the source. Anton Chaitkin and Matt Everett were associated for some time, in the case of Chaitkin, for many years, with the LaRouche group.
Right, yes.
Yeah, and I must say, I remember when they ran two people who won public office in the state of Illinois back in the 1980s, the smear campaign that was mounted by the system, by the establishment, against them. I thought that for decades that they could never, ever overcome it. The smear was so intense, so thorough, so continuing, that I thought maybe no one can make a comeback if the smear is that powerful. But they're still there today. And I didn't pay much attention to their earlier ideas, even though I read much of what Lyndon LaRouche was writing. But what they're doing today is very, very helpful to the United States, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
That's the LaRouche people of today.
I don't know what they're doing. And Matt sort of, I don't think he identifies as being part of the organization today. He's on his own. But,
I can understand that, because the smear, again, even if you mention their names, you risk being placed along with this into this smeared group, and it doesn't make any difference what they're saying. See, they never said the LaRouches ever did anything wrong. They're just saying you're a LaRouche, and that by itself, that should be enough to take you out of contention of any belief.
Yeah, I'm just going to put a link to, they got their own pack. So yeah, I agree. I didn't hear anything about LaRouche until I started looking into truth. I've been looking into truth since 2012. And I think Webster Tarpley used to talk about him, and I heard Webster on the Alex Jones show quite a bit. So that was my only exposure, I think, to that.
I wouldn't have been as careful as you, I think, or as rigorous as you, had I not discovered this genocide in the public record office in England. Mm-hmm. That to me was a shocker, and it changed everything for me. In fact, when your basic belief system is shaken, it seems that millions of synapses in one's mind have to be rejiggered. And I had kind of a headache for a few years while all that was being sorted out.
Yeah. Wait. So what year? So you're 87 now. Yeah. So what? How old were you, or what year was it when you figured out that there weren't just a bunch of potatoes that went bad that year in Ireland?
I would never have learned it had I not been doing my grandfather's biography. Mm-hmm. I went over to England. He was a British soldier. A bit ashamed to say. Yeah. And he served in from 1857 until 1891. And so I was doing his biography, and while doing his biography, I stumbled across all this genocide.
Yeah. What year was that, though? What year was that?
In the early 80s.
Okay. So you've really been aware of the official story being wrong for a long time.
And have been smeared ever since I started getting the word out in pamphlet form. And then the crimes against us by the FBI started a few years later.
Right, because that's the only way if they can't fight the truth with if they can't convince people of the truth, or they want to get rid of your truth, then it's easier just to either assassinate you or character assassinate you or whatever means it takes to shut you up.
Yes, and the Irish government are the main proponents of the smear job. The smears are coming from both the FBI and also the Irish government. The British government are not doing it directly. They're not the ones who are
doing it by proxy. Yeah,
yeah. It's the Irish government and the entire Irish academia that mm-hmm. is behind the lie. Any professor or history in Ireland who teaches the truth will immediately lose their livelihoods.
And where else have we heard that today? Today we're seeing a repeat of that in another psychological operation, the COVID thing. So obviously this is a well-oiled machine. These guys know how to run the world. They know how to capture academia. Now they're capturing all institutions in society because they want to burn it to the ground and rebuild it in this technocratic hell that is going to be put upon us or already halfway is done. So, yeah, that's why I like studying history, because it just repeats or rhymes, at least.
Yeah. The Marist brother who once taught me back in Castlereagh, mm-hmm. A wonderful, very hard word, very dedicated teacher, truthful in all areas except the one, and he taught famine. Later in retirement, he was asked by an ex-student, "Brother, you now call it genocide. Why did you teach us all famine in school?" And Brother Ender replied, "I had no choice. I had to teach the curriculum as provided to me by the government." So here he is, a man of the cloth, a religious man, within an order, the Marist order of Christian brothers. And he lied and fabricated history throughout his entire teaching career. And even though his own family, his own relatives, had been murdered under that same regime, as did the relatives of the students he was teaching. I frankly don't get it. But the corruption had spread to the academia of the United States. And there was a dig of a murdered village of not coming to me now. It's on the Strokestown, on the estate of the Pakenham estate. The Pakenham family, by the way, it was one of their sons who was general of the British Army in the attack on New Orleans in 1815. He was killed there. And a subordinate officer of General Pakenham was Edward Blakeney. Okay. Who was the commander-in-chief of the Irish Holocaust. He was in commander of the 67 regiments removing Ireland's food. As they neared completion of their mission of genocide, Queen Victoria conferred on General Edward Blakeney a prestigious Order of the Bath. He had been a knight previously, but this was another Order of the Bath, which he conferred upon him as he neared completion of his mission of genocide, again in 1849. So the notion that Queen Victoria was sympathetic to the Irish and was concerned about them is refuted by the record.
Was your grandfather part of the regiments that were moving food?
No, he was 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years of age. Okay. When the regiment that he later joined was starving the people of South County Galway.
Mm-hmm. So he was a little too young to have joined. Is that what you're saying? That was a little after. Are you still there? Uh-oh. Ooh, he's got one bar left. Okay, we'll just wait for Chris to come back. I have no idea what's going on. This story is deep. This story is running deep. Oh, there you are. Your internet glitched out there, Chris. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry, you went to zero connectivity there, but at least you didn't get hung up on. So you're saying that your dad came, your granddad came along a little later after the food removal machine was running.
No, he was a child of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years of age during it.
Right. So, yeah, he would have been, he didn't join the army then.
He joined in 1857 when he turned 18. He joined.
Did he find it? But so there was there anyone around that could have told him the truth when he joined, do you think? Or?
Well, his superiors must have
known.
Known because he was kept overseas his entire career.
Wow. So they did know that he would be a liability if he was.
Probably. There was only one purely Irish regiment at the time, the Connaught Rangers, the 88th of Foot. And they were kept in the Caribbean and Malta and different places. They were never deployed into Ireland in those years because they definitely would not have participated in that.
Right.
So they were kept out.
So did you ever come to a conclusion why they were starving the Irish? Did they really want to just kill them off because they didn't think they were superior? Or an empire has use for bodies. I mean, they could have spread them all around the empire to help settle the empire and take control. But do you think that was part of it as well? Or
well, if that was the case, they would have shipped them out. But they're all in them. They're mostly in mass graves. Mm-hmm. Only the ones who could afford to buy a passage on a ship got out anywhere. Oh, the landlords did send a few out. They paid for a few trips, a few voyages up to Canada.
Yeah.
At one point, there was some 47 ships in a row waiting to be of Irish immigrants waiting to be unloaded in Gros Isle.
Yeah, that's my great-grandfather. He must have come through there. I'm serious. Yeah. And I think the Canadian government gave him 100 acres on the Ottawa River. And that is not farmland, believe me. It's garbage land, but it's terrible, rocky, dirty, crappy soil. And living in Ottawa is a miserable place most of the year, even in the summer. So I don't know how the heck, but they were given land right down to the Ottawa River. So he must have been among those ships.
My book contains quite a bit about the arrival of the people in Canada. You might find it interesting. There was a mass grave of many acres around a cathedral in Toronto, and it shows the locations of a number of mass graves in Canada. including the site of a crash of a vessel on the Gaspé Peninsula.
Right.
And the bodies buried alongside. I wish I'd never discovered this, because to know the history of Ireland is to live in sort of a constant grief. And I'm finding now that that's true of so many countries, so many places.
I'm reading this here now. You're right. It says many thousands died during 1845 to 50, especially in 1847, in a tent city behind St. Paul's at 83 Power Street. That's downtown Toronto. Basilica built by an earlier Irish generation close to the disembarkation point. You mean they sailed all the way to Toronto? You figure?
Yes.
So they were dead when they arrived, because that's amazing. That's really interesting.
Oh, no, they moved into a tent city on the grounds of that church, and they were treated there, and they were buried in trenches alongside their tent town.
So they died in Toronto just because they were, they weren't British, or they weren't English, so I guess they were just treated so badly, they just starved to death in Toronto. That is amazing.
That's not quite the story. They were so weak from previous malnutrition and the trip over.
Okay.
That they tended to be vulnerable to diseases.
And right.
I don't remember cholera. Cholera, I think, was the main disease up there. Typhus, I'm not sure which. Right. But they were wiped out by a disease. You couldn't really blame the local authorities, in my opinion. It was a lengthier process than merely shutting off the food.
No, it's malnutrition. Yeah. One of the things that Northern Tracy, who I thought would come in tonight, and I discussed, is there's only a few ways to get sick: injury, malnutrition, and toxicity or poisoning. So, yeah, just the fact that they weren't fed properly, probably on the passageway from Ireland, which probably took a few weeks, if not a month.
And they were just dumped in the ocean as they came over. It's been said that that if the number of spots along the ocean could be marked with white crosses, that you could walk across the Atlantic on the on the tops of the crosses.
So how many people do you think were relocated to North America? How many Irish do you figure? Because so they were just cast off to get them over here, and or was it to get them over here to help, or just to get them out of Ireland, do you figure?
Well, the landlords paid their, they booked a number of ships. One of them was an English lord on Queen Victoria's inner advisors group. Mm-hmm. But he shipped them off, and it was an order to just leave enough there to save the crops. And we didn't want any more people to feed than was necessary to make him rich. Mm-hmm. And so that's how that worked. Funny that the name is not coming to me of that lord.
So just excess Irish? They just figured we don't need this many? And I guess there's probably a child born to every family every year, pretty much, I'm guessing.
Well, Malthus was a main philosopher leading much of the English policy in those years.
Right, Thomas Malthus, yeah.
Yes, and so he claimed that the population was rising geometrically while agricultural expands arithmetically, linearly, and it made a certain sense at the time, except that agricultural production has become multiply richer, easier.
Mm-hmm. Mechanization, of course, makes sense.
And fertilizer, but above all, mechanization.
Right.
And to abandon human muscle power and then for horse muscle power and then for mechanization made a world of difference.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm inclined to think that the same science that achieved that ought to fairly easily and soon be able to offset the pollution problem, obviate the pollution problem.
Oh, yeah, I know. You're just talking about what they want to do now and in today. I agree. I don't think there's ever a population problem, but you really woke me up. I'm going to put a link to 83 Power Street because I know Toronto inside out, but I just didn't recall this location exactly. But now I'm going to look into that. That is fascinating.
If you go down a little bit farther on that page, or maybe the next page, you'll see that in a sense, the Irish who died there in quite a few thousands in that one location, that they are memorialized today by a dog toilet.
Yeah, it says right here, a dog toilet. I don't know if you can see that.
Orphan's Green Speech.
That is crazy. Now covered by St. Paul Catholic School parking lot and playground. Also by a city. So the burial grounds are being desecrated to this day.
Yes, yes.
It's crazy.
Yes, and you'll see one there in the town of the other major town there, Montreal, that there was a huge boulder that was placed over a mass grave by people building a bridge across the main river there. But the boulder was removed from the mass grave, and the boulder had been placed there in order to mark the mass grave with respect for the bodies in the mass grave. But the city of Montreal moved the boulder to another location.
That's terrible. Well, Toronto's still being run by an Orangeman today, so it doesn't surprise me. You know, our prime minister is so busy apologizing to the natives here that they forgot about all the Irish among, I guess the Irish might have been the biggest group that is buried en masse in Canada, maybe even more than the natives.
Yes,
or at least a similar number. It's crazy.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. That's where we are. In any event, I'm not a specialist in sympathy toward the Irish. This makes me aware of all of the cruelty everywhere on Earth, and has been a desperately cruel place, and it needn't be. It could be heaven if people decided that that's what they would do. And I must say, it's only a tiny handful of psychopaths who have been able to turn it into a hell on Earth for so many people.
That's because of the good nature of humanity in general. They just don't recognize evil when it's barking right in their face. I think it's a human flaw that the psychopaths take advantage of, that humanity is just so good for the most part that they just don't recognize evil, and it's all around. And then we get accused of being chicken littles when we call it out. And you're calling it out, and what thanks have you got? Not much, because I've never heard of you before, other than Matt Arrett. But I was aware of the Irish Holocaust, and I knew the potato famine part was a lie, and I just thought that the British loaded all the food up onto the boats and just sunk the ships. But maybe that's what they did as well. But I didn't know anyone was really looking into it like yourself.
Yeah, well. And I wouldn't have made a study of it, except that I stumbled upon it. Mm-hmm. And then once you stumble upon a genocide, you must do what you can to expose it. And so I'm hoping that others join me in this. I must say, my book is the only one in existence that even mentions the British regiments, except for Cecil Woodham Smith's book in 1962. And she spent about a total of 3/4 of a page describing 13 regiments and their struggles in robbing the people of their food crops. But then she buried that under so much stuff but in any event, only her book and my book ever, of all the books, and there are thousands of books on the so-called famine.
Sure. Hers is The Great Hunger, right? That's
precisely it. Exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly it. So that she briefly mentions it, but it buries it under so much other stuff. She even says that the people chose to not eat their own food production, which is truly strange.
Well, why would people not eat what they?
Exactly.
That makes no sense.
Makes no sense. And yet she said things like that. I'm told that at the time she would not be able to get published if she did not tone things down. In my case, things had loosened up by the time I finished my, and I'd never thought I would have to do a book. I thought a pamphlet will be enough to get the truth out. And it went into, I think, a number of millions of copies, certainly hundreds of thousands from us. but and others were photocopying and going on like that. And I thought that would be enough, but I found that the famine historiographers continued to promote their old lies, so that I thought I'd better do a book in order to try to adopt their format, and it still hasn't silenced them.
Well, and luckily you lived long enough to see the internet, where we have this window of time, which I don't know if it's going to last, where anyone who wants to can publish and speak about these kinds of things. Now, most people don't even understand what the internet is 25, 30 years later, and they're stuck in their Facebooks and their YouTubes, where they get censored and they don't see stuff like this, and they don't realize that the agents of doom operate anywhere where the people are and can control and suppress information. So the idea that I've been doing this for 10 years and, well, you get distracted, of course, by other things, but that I haven't heard of you or the book is a testament to the fact that the agents of doom are everywhere, distracting and diverting us from learning truth.
By the way, it's important to maybe mention here, this book that you have showing there, that's available on Amazon.com and or from me directly. Anyone can contact me. Maybe if you, my email address is my name, Fogarty C, altogether. Fogarty C,
but, you know,
C for Chris.
You don't mind that I put the book on my site, the PDF, do you? You want it distributed?
I would really appreciate that.
Okay, it is on my website then. So I have a link to it directly. You can just download it off my website as well.
Yes.
And it's called The Perfect Holocaust and Who Kept It, quote unquote, Perfect. But if you want to pay, if you want a signed copy or you want a copy, they can get it directly from you. And your website is irishholocaust.org. Is that correct?
Well, that's put up by my friend. But if I'd like to give my email address, if you don't mind, fogarty@att.net.
I don't mind. I'll put that link too on my website.
Wonderful. So or from Amazon.
Okay. Or you can
I'm not a big fan of Amazon, but
they're just about the only game in town. So you don't have a hell of a choice, do you? So that'll be number 10. That will be your email address. So if they want to contact you, they can. And get that, get the book through. So what do you just mail it directly from your place? Is that what you do?
Exactly. In fact, all sales on Amazon come to me and I send it out to the local post office.
Oh, I see. So it's sort of a drop ship situation. And how much is the book if they want a hard copy?
$25 plus $4.16 postage.
Right, if you're in the United States, that's $1 million if it goes to Canada. So,
I would advise anyone in Canada to do have a look at the ebook, because postage out of here. I just paid to Switzerland yesterday. I paid $35 or $38 for the postage alone.
It's crazy. Everything is electronic these days, and I have a million PDFs to read as well. So this, if you want to read it right away and get everything, you can download it right off my website. I'll put a link to today's show. This is show 627.
To recap, it's the starvation of Ireland involved the deployment of more than half of Britain's army into Ireland. Mm-hmm. Where they robbed the Irish producers of their agricultural production and escorted it to the ports from where it was exported, mostly to Britain, and it fed the British army everywhere and was sold on the markets of Europe, while the Irish people starved to death. It's a shocking genocide, and it's an honor to be able to speak for the murdered millions. After they were murdered, they were slandered. They were slandered as having improved the world's gene pool by falling into a lethal trap of their own making, by growing only one failure-prone crop. A whole series of falsehoods. They grew a tremendous variety of different kinds, all kinds of foods, in abundance. and they were robbed of it. At the time, the land of Ireland was all owned by English landlords.
Exactly. So how can you blame the Irish if it was the English that owned the land? They're the ones that decided what to plant. The Irish were just the people that worked the land, weren't they?
Exactly that. Now, they also would have a small number of acres for which they had to pay rent.
Right.
And the rent charged to the Irish by the English landlords in Ireland was the same from coast to coast, that's from the Atlantic to the Irish Sea. And that is 250 to 260 days per year of unpaid labor. That's what you paid to it for the plot on which you could build your cabin and a few acres to grow some have a grass for a cow for the kids and an acre or two of grain and potatoes. And so all the rest. So in other words, just like the British in that genocide broke no laws, they were upholding the law because all of that food, most of the year's labor by the Irish actually belonged to the English landlords as rent payment. And on that basis, the English army, the British army, were merely protecting the landlord's property interests.
Right.
And so,
but the idea that it was the Irish's own fault is insane because, again, they didn't own the land. Most of the production was probably set out by the lords. And yes. And they confiscated, by my math, 68% of the food production for the year. Although probably the whole year is not growing season, I'm sure, in Ireland. And so
when you consider that for the Irish to work for the remainder of the year to work for themselves was 105 to 115 days, including Sundays. So they had to live off what they produced in those 105 to 115 working days a year.
But which days were they? Because you can't grow all year round, can you, in Ireland?
No, and that's another point. In fact, and the landlords had the selection as to what days they would have them work. So if
they have the four lousy months where you can't grow anything, no wonder they starved. The British took all the food from the production days because there's not 24/7 production. This isn't Florida or the Caribbean.
Right, exactly. It's, in fact, you know, something I hadn't thought about that, but that's a very, very good point. So it was one of the world's concealed genocides.
Wow.
And we ought not permit genocides to be concealed. We were better than that. We should not permit that to go on.
And you're saying in 2022, I've heard you say this, that to this very day, this is not being acknowledged by even the Irish government, which you, I think you've said, is sort of an occupied government. There was a people's government that was formed maybe 100 years ago, a parallel government as well in Ireland. And that still, to this day, Ireland is not really represented by Irish people or people that are on the Irish side.
Yes, the government of Ireland that the world knows is a successor organization to the one that was set up by King George V and Lloyd George on the 6th of December, 1921. Mm-hmm. It replaced the one that had been created by those who were voted into office in the 1918 election. They formed the government on the 21st of January, 1919. And it existed as a free country until December 6, 1921, at which time.
So 2 years.
Yes.
So for two.
Yes.
So basically Ireland is an occupied country still by the English. They still occupy Ireland. Is. All of it.
Yes.
So
all of it. Yes.
Explicitly Northern Ireland and implicitly the rest of the island, which is called EIR. EIR.
Sad to say, it's so sad, and no truth can be told about Irish history in either part of the island.
And you will refer to this as a Holocaust, and when most people in the entire world today, including me, think of Holocaust, they think of what happened in Nazi Germany. So that word is sort of exclusive to what we're told went on in Germany. Now, do you think that's on purpose? Because was this always referred to as a Holocaust, as you said, for hundreds of years? And then we have the Holocaust of World War II that's sort of taken over the word?
Yes. Well, again, it was reported in the Cork Examiner newspaper starting on the 4th of May, 1846, and continuing on a frequent basis until the November 19th, 1855. Holocaust was a word used to describe it throughout those years. And also other writers at the time, Michael Davitt and James Fitzpatrick and other people at the time described it as Holocaust. There was no other word, so they evidently went to the Bible and took that word and used it. And it has become another word for genocide ever since. But however, in my time in Ireland, it wasn't called Holocaust. We were taught in school it was famine.
Right, right. So that's my point. Like, they take words and they promote them to mean only one thing. So there was a actual German Holocaust. There was an organized plan by the British, English, the Empire to wipe out Germans before World War II. So that was a mission statement. There were books written on it. So that's why I'm saying I don't speak of the Holocaust that we're not supposed to speak of in Canada, because I'm not going to waste my time getting tied up in that possible legal trouble, because they've made it, as they have in Germany and many other countries in Europe, just you can't talk about it. But as far as I know, as you were saying, there are more than one Holocaust that were possibly even worse. So I think if the British are still running the world, they're not going to want people to look into the Irish Holocaust, or, like I just said, the German nation's so-called Holocaust. So it's.
By the way, is Germany in the process of being wiped out today?
Yes. Well, there was a book that I never heard of when I was doing my revisionist literature or reading and Ernst Zundel was reading from. It's called Germany Must Perish. Like, they literally wanted every German wiped off the map. And it sounds like it's the same thing with Ireland in the 1840s. Same playbook.
But why would the German government cut off its own supply of fuel without which the nation cannot survive?
Well, I think it was clear, and I heard Matt talking about it today on another one of his shows. Germany, like most other most countries in the world, are occupied by the United States, which is a country that has been taken over by the Venetian Empire because of its previous wealth and its previous military. Like, Germany's an occupied country. I believe I heard there's 49 American bases in Germany. So they've been occupied for a long time. So they're
how do they get the consent of the people?
No consent at all. I think it's just, that's how you keep a country under your control. You have your military there and you tell people it's for your protection. And it's crazy.
Well, it's the same. You see, they have elections there. They're supposedly free elections. They have supposedly free elections in Ireland. So I don't understand why the people don't free themselves.
I think just lack of knowledge and just general complacency and so many other things. Like I said, the British know how to control the human mind. Tavistock, they study it to perfection, and that's what they do. That's their specialty, keeping the young people stupid, down, and if they want to wipe out the most dangerous part of society, which are young men, they put them in the army and get them killed there, or they dope them up, or they make them addicted today to video games, make them lethargic. Everything, every plan under the book. These guys are so smart, the people that run the world. We have to give them credit, and you've uncovered a lot. This painting as the book cover, is that something that you had commissioned or you found this?
Yes. I just gave instructions to some computer savvy people and they put it together for me. Comical to mention, the flock of sheep down the way.
Right here?
One stage, Yeah, down at one stage, they had a row of red coats, each with a sheep on a leash alongside.
Oh, right. So, here, yeah.
Yeah, so evidently they did not know that sheep travel only in flocks. You don't have them on leashes.
They're not like dogs. Yeah. Oh, that's funny. So you had to recommission it, or you had to edit it a bit. It's actually pretty good. What's your wife think about all this? You've spent the last half your life devoted to this.
She is as wounded by the genocide as I am. And she's willing to commit the rest of her life, like I am, to speaking for those people. It's we remain in a form of grief, and wish it were not true, but the crime was perpetrated, and we must acknowledge it. And it made us more aware, made us more sympathetic to what the crimes we've perpetrated in Iraq and all around the world. And we're hoping to have an effect. We do contact our political representatives on a frequent basis, have zero effect that we know about, and yet we continue to do it. We engage in street protests and rallies, have been for many decades, and will continue to do it, thinking that we're having making no change there either. And yet we try to smarten up and do it in smarter ways. And we know our obligations, and we try to fulfill them.
It's amazing. Do you have any allies in the Irish community, or is the Irish diaspora just so scattered that they don't care anymore? It's too far in the past.
Ireland has a very large heroic component in its population, maybe larger than most other people, because there is also a larger traitorous component. And so we are in touch with a great many people of absolute impeccable standing, and are privileged to know them. Many are in prison and have been in prison, and some have died on hunger strike. And my wife was on hunger strike for as long as we were in the federal jail in downtown Chicago. She was protesting against FBI crimes and went on hunger strike against them. But we bonded out after the third day was over, so there was no harm done to her. But we know people who one, I'm just thinking of right now, who was 56 days on hunger strike, and they came off it as a result of ordered office by their commanding officer, and it was the right thing to do. But others that we know Bobby Sands' sister, he was 60-some days on hunger strike.
Well, I remember Bobby Sands. I was wondering if you're going to bring him up. Yeah,
and his nine companions. But it's something that people do when there are no weapons left to them, when there are no tools remaining. They sort of put their bodies on the line. I don't condone it, because I think it is a bet on the moral standing of the targeted nation. And there was a time when the English people had a little bit more integrity than they seem to have today. And I think hunger strikes against the British government have been a bad bet for the last 30 years.
I don't even hear about hunger strikes really anymore, to be honest. It's sort of an old tactic that I don't think it worked.
No, the propagandists seem to be able to smear it in advance and render it useless and only a self-sacrifice. Margaret Thatcher is revered because she did nothing to change the, didn't take them, didn't allow the political prisoners their rights as political prisoners, insisted upon. Mm-hmm. She changed the conditions under which they were imprisoned from political prisoner to ordinary criminal, and they resisted that. And they died.
I'm just looking at the death of Bobby Sands, which is numerologically suspicious again. 66 days and age 27. You see, some of the things I look into media fakery is numerology. I don't know if you ever come across it, but when you see all these occult numerologies, you have to be very, or I'm very suspicious of the whole story now. This is a little before my time and before my research, but this is what I love about history. All the numbers come up, so you wonder, did it really happen, or was it just another psychological operation to manipulate people?
Yes.
So yes. They're really good at it. Let me tell you, Chris.
I have often thought that numerology is to mathematics, mm-hmm. what astrology is to astronomy, and what martial music is to music.
I don't discount it. It does seem silly, but the problem is when you look into all the new numbers about stories in the media, and that's how I got into this media fakery. The numbers just keep coming up. So to me, it's Masonic code that the people that run the place, if they can get away with doing things without killing people, I think they do it. I'm not saying that they're not evil and they wouldn't be above doing it, but I think for simplicity and expediting a situation and avoid any kind of real consequence, if they just fake a lot of these stories, they can, and it's the same effect. The perception is the same as reality. I think Kissinger said something like that. So,
yeah, someone has noted our case number when they framed me and my wife and two friends, okay, based upon an audio tape that they themselves had previously criminally fabricated. The case went down for 15 months, but the case number was 91 CR for criminal. We were the criminals. 911. So 91 CR.
Okay. Thank you very much. You're telling my story.
but I had thought that those numbers, 91, you see, is for the year in which the case was initiated.
Okay. Right.
And then CR is for criminal. Mm-hmm. And there was crimes, but they were perpetrated. And then the 911, I thought that would be a sequential number in the number of cases that had been initiated since the beginning of the year. But I don't know.
Well, maybe it was. Maybe they never really. Maybe it was just to intimidate you. Maybe the whole thing was just to get you to shut up, and it was a warning shot across your bow. Maybe there was no real intent to prosecute you, and the fact that you got out real quick sort of maybe tells that. I think these people are. I think they have, and I've said this before, have parallel court systems in all the courthouses, especially the feds, where they run their operations, and they have real judges, or they have what I call sort of PSYOP judges and PSYOP prosecutors, and they run fake cases all the time. So I just think maybe you got tangled into that because you are telling a truth that they don't want, and they wanted to intimidate you to stop, but obviously it didn't work.
It didn't work, but they, when you know the amount of the bonds, you'll know that it wasn't fake. Mm-hmm. In order to get out of prison, it was $50,000 for my wife and $100,000 for me. Right. 10% down, but still a significant amount of money in order to get out. And we were facing the rest of our lives in prison.
Right.
And if they had accomplished that, they would have shut down all Irish American sympathy for the Irish situations. And so it was very important for them to try to win this case. And they did their very, very best. And again, keep in mind, it was based upon a criminally fabricated evidence, a fake evidentiary audio tape. They themselves. So
interesting. Is there anyone famous that can take up your cause, do a movie on this or something? Because, you know, what about your, do you have children? Are they interested in this to take up the cause?
No children. And I must say, I thank God for that because it would have been, we might have been, you know, much of what we see as lack of courage around us, mm-hmm. is often parents who are scared to death of their ability to take care of their children, if anything, if the government ever went after them.
Right.
So much of the acquiescence of, mm-hmm. the people is due to having hostages, children.
Yeah, I can see that. But on the other hand, what future do we want for our children if we're not going to fight? What about brothers and sisters or anybody that is an ally of yours? Do you have any of
plenty of allies, but And we got seven wonderful attorneys, mm-hmm. and they defended us well, and they brought, and they finally, through by getting long enough, they got what's called evidential. What is it? This is the word. The explanatory, the stuff that explains the case that the other party has. And okay. there they found that...
Disclosure?
It's very close to the word. Mm. There we found that the audio tape was a criminal fabrication. Wow. And we did that by the... On a motion to the judge, we demanded that the evidentiary audio tape be authenticated. The judge ordered the FBI to take it to a leading sound engineering firm in the Midwest here. They took it there, and there it was found to be a criminal fabrication. So there were no favors were done us, but some decent people who respect science did their jobs correctly. And our lawyers did a fine job, before they found the evidentiary audio tape criminally fabricated, they were trying a lot of other ways to save us. So they did their very best. On the other hand, they had all promised to take our case for damages. After it was, look, things were tipping our way and it looked like we were going to escape these criminals. They said they would all of them would take our case for damages against the criminals. But when it came to it, they all refused. And there would have been millions in it for them had they taken it. So they feared probably by, I think, maybe $1 million each of fear that caused them to turn down this windfall of millions to themselves. So they got the word from somewhere that they had better not participate. There was a letter from the Justice Department to the sergeant in charge of the investigation who was leading it, telling him what orders to follow. So that told us then that the U.S. Justice Department was involved in these crimes with the FBI. And then the post office, a letter carrier told us that the FBI had contacted her post office and told them to set our mail aside for the FBI to go through once or twice a week, and that no one had better tell us or they'd be imprisoned themselves. She was courageous enough to tell us, and so there you have the U.S. Postal Service involved in these crimes by the FBI. So again, the U.S. Justice Department, U.S. Post Office, and the IRS accused me of not paying adequate taxes on my income earned while working in El Salvador, and they had me paying $1,000 a month. Shortly after the FBI crime started, they forced me to pay $1,000 a month until the crimes by the FBI ended or were proven to have been crimes, and then the IRS claims just stopped. This didn't demand any more payments, but they never reimbursed me for the thousands that they had extorted from me under the basis of immediate imprisonment by them.
You so and Al Capone get you with taxes.
Yes, they did that. Yes, they did that. And again, I told them either I owe the taxes or I did not owe the taxes. The only one mistaken outcome would be to extort half of the total from me and not extort the remainder. So if you'd taken one side or the other, that I didn't owe any of it and reimburse me or insist upon collecting all of it, you might have been theoretically right. But the one way you had to be proven yourself wrong was to stop extorting it and keep what you had extorted.
Now, why is it called the perfect Holocaust, and who kept it perfect? Did you explain that before?
Maybe, but it's in the title because we all know all our lives about the perfect crime, how you perpetrate the perfect crime. So this is a rare one. This is the perfect Holocaust, has been kept perfect. And then in that book, it says who kept it perfect. And it names the professors and the presidents of Ireland and the Justice Department and the people who are keeping the truth hidden. You will be in violation of that group. You won't be among who kept it who kept it secret, who kept it perfect, I should say. Again, it comes from the perfect crime. The perfect crime is a crime that has never been detected.
Do you think the Lords still own Ireland? I know you said maybe they redistribute it to Irish, but do you think the Lords of England still own Ireland today?
No, some of them were allowed to keep their domains. Mm-hmm. In each, we'll say, 50,000-acre estate, there might be 120 or maybe 500 acres around the house that was grazed mm-hmm. in order to keep it a field of fire so the people in the house could defend themselves okay. if they were attacked. And they grazed that area, and then they farmed all the other surrounding miles. And so many of them were allowed to keep their domains. So they still, some of them still have their castles and still have a few hundred acres of what used to be the grassland around the houses. And so they're still there. But they all have been stripped of their farmland and have been since 1900, 1910.
Amazing. Before we go, we've had a good show so far. I've learned a lot. What do you think is going on today with regards to COVID? Because you've been awake for a long time, 40 years. What do you think is happening? What is the purpose of what they're doing? And what do you think of the vaccine and the idea of COVID? And what's your take on it?
Yes. My wife and I took two shots, so that tells you something.
And why?
I had decided not to, and she would not. She would had been told by her doctor that she had to take it or she wouldn't get some treatment. Mm. And so I walked her down, and because of the thousands, there was a huge, huge area like a aircraft hangar full of people. And because I was there with her, and I took the first one, and then another one in a couple of weeks later I took. And I was very doubtful about the whole thing. Since then, we've got a whole lot more evidence. Now it seems to be part of a world population thinning effort mm-hmm. By the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab. And it now turns out that Prince Charles, now King Charles, was one of the earlier exponents of it. Proponents of it,
right.
Along with Kissinger and others. So we're learning as we go. And
did you have any side effects personally?
None.
Okay.
You know, I'm aging at a much more rapid rate since I got the shots. I have to say that.
Do you think so? Does that
yes.
Sound, wow.
Yes. And I don't like it. It hasn't killed me in any event. So I think we've been lucky, and I think a lot of those earlier shots were water or something insignificant. But I really, and what's more, we're beyond the age of procreation, so our genes will not be passed on defectively to.
No, that's true. Yeah. And so what, so your wife is okay? She didn't have any bad effects?
Also, nothing that we can say was a result of her shots.
Right.
So, but obviously we'll take no more, and so, we told the doctors that. Meanwhile, the doctors themselves, the hospitals are insisting that masks be worn, mm-hmm. and so we're very concerned about the destruction of the medical profession in the United States, because it is destroyed. It has no more credibility.
Yes, yes, I agree. So what do you think the big plan is, and who do you think is running this whole thing? I know we have the enemy, Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab, but it's got to go higher.
Yes, I'm aware of the neocons having been almost exclusively dual citizenship Israeli-American. There's that's a component of almost all of this. We daren't speak of it in most cases because of the anti-Semitism smear. But I think that ought to be looked at also. Beyond that, I don't have much more. Well, I have become more aware of the German situation. World War II is not clear like it.
Yeah.
It was a whole lot. It was a little bit clear. It was vague. The outlines seemed to be kind of roughly okay. Now there's nothing okay about it, and not about any of the other wars either.
Right. And, are you just kind of figuring this out now in the last couple of years? Now that you're really aware that it's so easy to fool people on a massive scale.
The moment of great pain to me was just was the discovery of genocide at the public record office in Kew, England.
That was in the '80s, though, right? Or sorry, that was in the '80s, 40 years ago.
And until then, I was a complete consumer of the international news media, believing all of it, essentially believing all of it, and so that was the shifting event, and it was painful because as I mentioned, our worldview requires a certain connection of millions of mental of nodes and synapses, I guess, and when that is demolished, a resorting takes place, and even that one must be tentative because we don't know for certain many other components of reality. And so, but the rejiggering itself, it, to me, was like a mild headache that lasted for a number of years.
And now you're in a new headache with the COVID thing. This has got to blow your mind.
When I'm talking about actual pain in the head, and I've never had pain. I've never had ordinary headaches like some people do.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But this was not a kind of a moral pain. It was a physical pain that I think has to do with the mental rejiggering that has to take place when all of one's foundational beliefs are destroyed.
Do you have any idea if your own family? You were born in Chicago, so that means your parents came over here,
right?
Did they come over? Were they the ones that came over, or was it their parents?
Yes. Yeah. No, they came over. Yeah, they were born in Ireland both, yeah. They met here in Chicago.
So did they leave? They wouldn't have left in the 1840s. They would have probably been born in the 1800s?
1904, 1906, and then they lived into their 70s and 90s.
Yeah, my grandfather was born in 1906 too, in Quebec.
Well, this is my father now. He was born in 1906. So.
No, I understand. Well, you're a generation ahead of me, but my...
Yes.
And his father came over from, I think, County Cork.
Any idea? The chief towns of Cork are Cove, Cork, Fermoy, Mallow, Youghal, Kinsale, Bantry, Douglas, and Blarney. Each is very, very distinctive. Do you have any idea? And they probably didn't come over from a town. They probably came from a surrounding farm.
I don't know. I'd have to ask my mother. I'd have to ask her. She's the one that sort of looked in. Yeah. I'll have to dig it up. I'll have to find out because I'm kind of curious now if she even knows.
But. As you know, the county, what do you call it? The axiom, the word is Rebel Cork. Mm-hmm. Because they were notoriously in rebellion constantly against British control. Where I'm from in County Roscommon, we're called the Roscommon Sheep Stealers.
Where's that county? I'm looking for it now.
Roscommon. In the upper left.
I see it. Roscommon, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then west of us is Mayo, and the slogan for Mayo is, Mayo, God help us. Because the land is so poor and the people have been pushed over there from the good land and they have always been too many people for the fertility of the soil. And so they've always lived in poverty there.
Isn't that something? So Malthus is kind of right about them. I mean, if it comes to supporting the population.
Yes, yes. So
how much do you know if your own family suffered with the food confiscation? Your own, your father's family?
They had survived. My paternal grandfather was born in the shadow of a gallows that the landlord Ashbrook had set up on a hill up the hill from his castle gates. Mm-hmm. That Lord Ashbrook had evicted his parents, my grandfather's parents, and his older sisters from their tenancy in 1836. So they were living with no means of subsistence beside the landlord's gallows to have them handy to be hanged if they cause any trouble.
Oh, you're kidding! Wow.
So they moved down the hill, 2 years after my grandfather's birth, they moved away from the gallows down the hill and into a house in the village, into security and comfort, where they could. And it was there, from there, that my grandfather, when he turned 18, joined the British Army. He must have survived as a laborer on the land, the landlord ash crop stuff, work of different kinds. But when he was 18, he walked to Abbey Leash and joined the British Army. That was in 1857, and he remained in the British Army until the year that the British military gave up the cat of nine tails as a tool of military discipline, and that was 1881.
Is there any way countries all around the world are acknowledging sins of their past? Canada is one of the biggest ones that does that. We even have a Truth and Reconciliation Day. That's a new holiday here from as of last year. It was last week for all our federal government. They took another day off. They take so many days off. So we're very contrite and very celebratory, I guess, of the sins of our past. Is there any chance that can happen in Ireland, or is there not?
Here's how it's happening. The President Higgins of Ireland last year went to Australia, where he begged the forgiveness of the Australian Aborigines as to the crimes perpetrated against their ancestors by the Irish in Australia. At the time, the Irish and Australians were felons. Right. They were stripped of all rights. Right. And the notion that those prisoners, being worked to death, many of them, were the ones responsible for the similar crimes against the Aboriginal Australians is
ridiculous. Are there any Irish in Ireland that are trying to bring this up or get some kind of compensation for the atrocities, or are they just too captured by the British Empire to do anything? Yeah.
Well, the ones that have been outspoken about it are in prison.
Wow.
In Port Leash prison. And we send Christmas cards and things over to them during the year. And in McGabbery prison in the six counties under British rule. There are now more Irish patriots in prison in the Republic of Ireland than there are in British occupied Ireland.
So what does that tell you? That there's you guys, what about, the IRA, and what's the guy's name? Jerry
Adams.
Right. Yeah. Is he your closest? Is he your best chance at getting any kind of publicity on this? Or is he captured?
Well, he led MI6's effort to get the Republicans to shut up and accept the surrender, the sign over of the six counties to Britain. The Good Friday Agreement that was done 6 months before the Omagh bombing had signed over the six counties to Britain. They were surrendered.
Right.
And Gerry Adams led that campaign for the British government to surrender to the British government.
So he's not going to be any help?
No. No. he's posturing as in favor of a united Ireland.
What about Ian Paisley? He was, I guess, in charge of Northern Ireland, so he's not an ally.
His son is there now. Ian Paisley was actually a pastor of a very violently Protestant church in the north. He had been a Methodist, and then he became a Presbyterian, and then the Presbyterians kicked him out, and he formed the Free Presbyterians, and then the Free Presbyterians. So he would try to get to organize the Protestants to attack the local. He tried to get a civil war going.
Yeah, sorry, I picked the wrong side there. That name just came. So there are. I can't think of any sort of inspired leaders of Ireland that would want to get this information out. Can you?
Well, the Irish Republican Brotherhood are there, and there are quite a, you know, there's the Irish National Graves Association that maintain the graves of those who died for Ireland, because the Irish government do not want those graves noted or noticed by anybody.
Yeah, and I heard you said you can't even get a gravestone made anymore. The two guys that did it for you, they suddenly retired.
Yes.
God.
So So things are, on the other hand, the government has become so gross in their abuse of the people that I think the people are finally waking up. On the other hand, they have embraced so much of this gender nonsense. In fact, I'll have to admit, the people of Ireland seem to be very obedient vassals of the international deep state.
They're like Canadians. Canadians are the same way. And I'm sad to say probably most northern states in America are the same way as well.
Isn't that interesting that the southern states are not? And that's very, very interesting, isn't it?
Well, they're called the flyover states. It's just a different way of looking at the world. I guess they're just a little more independent. I don't know what the reason is. I don't have a lot of hope that America is going to resist this New World Order takeover either, personally. I'm not seeing it. I don't see a lot of resistance. I think Trump is a bit of a clown in the sense he's put there on purpose to be part of the dialectic. You know, the people that rule over us, they use these dialectics to get what they want, the thesis, the antithesis, and then the synthesis. Yes. Trump is on one extreme, Biden is on the other, and they want it. It's going to settle somewhere in between. That's the whole point of it. So,
A bit more optimistic. Mm-hmm. I'm inclined to believe that the people will wake up. That certain amount of pain and incredible stuff being done to them will force them to wake up, and that they will wake up on time to save the nation and to save the Western world. That's my expectation. I don't think it's too far off either.
Oh no, it's good to be optimistic. I look for evidence. So, but getting back to Ireland, so there is no one spokesman in Ireland that is really could take up your cause
there are a great many, and in fact two just came to my attention within the last month.
Okay.
And so in fact I'll hook you up with them, because they're brilliant, wonderful orators, and they give me, and they're well educated. For a long time, well educated people in Ireland had learned that their futures will not be bright if they do not toe the line of the establishment. And so the cause of justice in Ireland was left to the laborers and the uneducated, and they were not making much progress. And so here are some some educated people now who are finally standing up and speaking, and they are evidently attacking the corrupt establishment, which has to be done in order to make any ground at all. And so that's what I see there. And it has to, the people I'm contacting here in the States who tended to go along with the news media, like I did myself for years, they see things a whole lot more clearly now. Ideas are finally making an impact. And I think things will turn soon. And again, they haven't achieved much yet, but they are starting to speak differently to how they used to speak.
Well, I don't know who linked my video where you were on with Matt Arrett, but it must be on some other website. I'll have to figure out where my hits are coming from. But this is definitely one of the most popular videos I've popped up that I didn't really think would be a big deal to the people that come to my website. Like I said, it's got almost 7,000 views. 10 people are watching it right now. And so that means somebody is interested. That's for damn sure.
It certainly did not come from me, because I did not know the address of it or how to tell people to watch it. So none of that is coming from my side.
Yeah, I don't know where it's coming from, because Matt has this video on his sites. But this is my site, my video platform that I pay for. And thanks to the donors at Fakeologist, they help keep it online. It's mirrored in four different places in the world: Montreal, New York, Los Angeles, Sydney, Nova Scotia, and somewhere in Germany. Ironically, not in England. I don't know why. That's where half of my viewers and listeners come from. England, number one, is the United States. But however, it's getting a lot of traction, so somebody must be interested in this story. So I'm really interested just from a historical point of view for my family. And I'm really grateful that I got you on the show. And I'm still amazed that you're 87 years old. If I'm doing half as well as you are at that age, that'll be amazing. I got a long ways to go, but I'm just...
There's a trick to it.
Well, no vaccines is on the list.
No, keep inhaling and exhaling.
Yeah, that's pretty... I don't have a choice on that, I don't think. But do you eat potatoes?
I do indeed. Yeah. Yes, indeed. But if you care, if anyone cares, I stopped eating meat some 10 years ago to a great extent, almost entirely, but have about 10 fruits and vegetables for dinner every day with just a taste of meat and oatmeal and oatmeal and blueberries in the morning. And that's about it.
That's what I'm doing, actually. We make our own. My wife makes me my oatmeal from whatever steel cut oats or whatever the hell it is.
Yes.
And I put the blueberries on it. Usually they're fresh for a while. And then I guess in another month, hopefully they'll still be flown or trucked up from Mexico.
Banana, by the way, and also a banana.
I do all that, but I still eat meat. I still love meat. So I'm not convinced that being a vegetarian is any magic solution. I just think eating a balanced diet, healthy diet, is the key. My grandfather died when he was 91, and
I think meat is actually essential if you're young and vital enough. As you get older, I think that fruits and vegetables are a bit more in line. We're not consuming as much energy as we were when we were younger, anyways.
Right, you have less energy needs, and meat is super dense in energy for sure.
Yeah, I agree
with that. Yeah, I'll be okay. My one side died when he was 91, and the other side when he was 101.
Oh, wow!
The last few years weren't the greatest, but he still had his brains till the very end. Which I'm not sure which I'd rather have, my body or my brains intact at the end. But he had his brains, but his body just didn't work at the last year.
My father was like the Englishman's description of a well-designed carriage. He operated perfectly up until 2 weeks of his death in his more than halfway through his 97th year.
Wow.
And he just went down all of a sudden, but was running his farm, doing all the work, driving his car, everything until a couple of weeks before he died.
Well, that's the way to do it. What do you think of do you have animosity towards the English or even the Queen for that matter?
Well, you couldn't hardly call it animosity. She was present at the time, for example, of the hunger strikers, and she was present when the British government was perpetrating all their tortures.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had an obligation that she did not fulfill. And Prince Charles, similarly, he's head of the very Para 2 or 3, the SAS group that murdered the people on Bloody Sunday, with complete impunity, by the way. By the way, the one piece of continuity through all of British rule in Ireland is that the right to murder in large numbers continues with complete impunity.
To this day?
Yes, to this day.
Why is that? Because they still don't think Irish are people?
Well, I don't know their motivation or what they expect, but I just know that they're not prosecuted.
That's pretty bad.
So the perpetrators of Bloody Sunday, the perpetrators of the Dublin Monaghan bombings, of 33 murders, 300 wounded by the British Army, and MI5 or MI6. McGurk's pub.
It's okay. I don't know. I can't help you because I don't know any of these things.
But in all of these, in any event, there are simply no prosecution, no investigation, or a fake investigation, and no prosecution. So this continues, including the right up to the date. Now, there hasn't been a mass murder done in a few years, but all of them done by the British government, all of them have not been prosecuted. And the Irish government doesn't seem to care.
Yeah, because I think, as you said, they're controlled probably by the British still to this day.
Yes, but Irish Republican Brotherhood and a number of others are there, and they will be. There will be a change coming in Ireland pretty soon, because only because the governance of Ireland is so outrageously bad for the people of Ireland.
Yeah, well, they got bigger problems, and we all have bigger problems. This is just worldwide technocratic takeover, so it might put the Irish Holocaust sort of in the back seat at the moment, because we're all being taken over by the same beast. So,
yes,
that is a bit of a problem. But anyway, I've had you for 2 hours. That was a great chat. I don't know if you think of anything else you want to talk about. Maybe we'll have you back sometime, because we can continue talking. And especially if you get the other guys you were talking about, we can maybe have a round table if you wanted and do some more chatting.
Yeah, exactly. That would be just one. We will do that. And I want to thank you so much, Tim. And by the way, you can always use the name for your last name, Tully, Tully. that's the Irish for flood.
Right.
And there's some.
I'll write that down. Tell my mother.
There are some prominent Tullys here in Chicago who have been in politics for years, clean politicians. Of course, that's not in the current era, but there were a Tully family in Chicago politics who were straight.
I like the music that Matt played at the beginning of the video. What was that? I don't know if you can hear this. Let me just play a bit. What is it? Bagpipes or something. Let's see if it plays. Hold on a sec. Let me just unmute it here. I had it muted. One moment. Here we go. What is this music? Do you know?
It could be a violin.
I'm just wondering if it was any particular hymn or song or something.
It's vaguely familiar. I don't have the name of it. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. It was a really good song he put at the beginning of the video. So
yes, but that 20,000, the pitiful thing about the Irish Holocaust, there's almost nothing in writing about it. Even the 2 million. Is a gross understatement of reality, and there's nothing that was printable at the time that would be permitted to tell the truth. I'm surprised that that was even allowed to be printed. By the way, here's a little bit of background. You have you ever read Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal?
No, I'm not a big reader, so I heard you talk about it, but go ahead.
Well, he was a bishop in the Church of Ireland, that is to say the Anglican Church that was imposed in Ireland. They called it the Church of Ireland, but it was tremendously anti-Catholic. And anyways, this was a conscientious man, Jonathan Swift, and he wrote a book, an essay called A Modest Proposal, and it was that the English landlords in Ireland ought to eat the children, because they make a nice meal before around 1 year of age or so, and that they would also accomplish the great good of saving them from the lives of their parents, whom the landlords have already eaten. But he would have, if he were an Irish person writing something that controversial about the British, he would be immediately executed. Jonathan Swift was not touched, but the printer who printed his essay was imprisoned for printing it.
Interesting. And that was from, what year was that?
About 1776 or so, or a bit before that.
Right. You know, you'd think the Pope would have something to say with regards to Ireland, you know, since they're mostly Catholic. Did he ever weigh in on this, or is he just quiet too, like all the rest?
He did. He prayed for the Irish, but he supported British policy 100%. And he excommunicated people who would support the Irish in their political efforts.
Well, we know who paid for him then. So much for that.
Yes. we could do another brief maybe show on that one because, but it might require visual because there's things that need to be brought out there in the original documents.
Well, you can put the visual on my screen and you can share your screen if you want. It'd be interesting. So, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, good. Well, we'll do that then the next time. Meanwhile, people can reach me for the book, and it's a sad story. But there's no opinion in it. It comes straight from the British government's own records. And to make it clear, the back half of the book, one half of the book, mm-hmm. is are exhibits in the nature of legal exhibits, evidence of crime.
Your book.
Yes, it shows the number of grain kilns, grain mills in Ireland, the number of flour mills, and the locations of every single one of them. The locations of every there you have part of it there.
Yeah.
And then in addition to the source of all the food processing, non-potato foods and their processing, then it also had it contains the manifests of ships. From the London Times newspaper of ships landing in different English ports and the amount of Irish food coming into it.
And right. Look at this. The evidence of existence of non-potato edibles as of 1831 to 1842 prior to the Holocaust. Antrim County had 56 corn mills, 13 corn kilns, all kinds of stuff. Wow.
And the location in at the next page after that starts off with the counties, Antrim, Armagh, all the way through mm-hmm. to the Wicklow alphabetically showing. And this is the information came from the Ordnance Survey maps of Ireland. They started in 1830 and they finished up in 1845 in Cork. And if you see the number, the page number for county, that's County Sligo. The page number 1, 2, 3 you see across, yeah. Working from left to right, working from north to south. And so each sheet has a number, number 19 there, 20, 21. And then within that sheet, it shows where that particular grain kiln, grain mill, et cetera, was. And so they're all named by townland. So all of that is beyond dispute. There's no opinion in it. It's merely a whole series of thousands of facts.
Of where the food was, basically.
The food processing, where it came from. And then how and when it was shipped out, when it was landed in England, how many this, how that, and the other. And then which British regiment was in which area and on what dates, until what dates. All of that is there. And then the mass graves they left behind are all there. Or at least a scattering, 180 of them are shown on the map. And then some more in other pages that you pointed out that include Canada. So the entire account is there. Oh, including the names of the landlords, and you can see that of all of the number of few thousands of English landlords or of landlords of Ireland, I should say, of all there are only a dozen or so Irish names. All of a couple of thousand are essentially all English, and they speak for themselves.
Wow, that's amazing. So you dug all this information up. It was all for public consumption, but you just did it. You just did the research. That's the difference. So it's all sitting there for anyone to go observe for themselves.
Exactly. So there's nothing of me in it. It's merely a compilation of official documents.
Well, you've even got the acreage of the different landlords. Wow. 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 Amazing. That's amazing. Yeah, and there's the documents there. So it's all in black and white if you don't believe it. And most people weren't shot. They were just, they just died of malnutrition, starvation, I suppose. That's the main thing, right?
Yeah. Some, in fact, the writers at the time were accusing the Irish of not being willing to face bayonets and bullets, mm-hmm. that fewer would die if more would. And by the way, there is the current house of the evictor, of the descendants of the victor, of the evictors of my great grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Lord Ashbrook's.
That's the current Lord Ashcroft's house in England, the current one. And there's the current Lord and the lady. And it was his great grandfather that evicted my great grandfather.
And they're English.
And they're English, living in England, in Cheshire, in England.
Wow. So you found them.
Yes. Mind you, they're there. It's a matter of record. It's there to me. They're there. They were his great grandfather almost killed my great grandparents, but didn't manage it. And so that's.
Did you send him a copy of the book?
I reached out. Oh, here, by the way, here's the this is the family crest of the Hawkins family. This is the source of their wealth. They're among the richest people in England.
Is that so? I never heard of them.
Yeah.
Amazing. You know, people always say Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos are the richest people. No. They're all the royalty and the earls and the dukes and the houses of the Venetian family. They're the richest people in the world. They've had the money for a long time.
Exactly. By the way, I misspoke. I don't know how much money the Hawkins have today, mm-hmm. but they were major families back in the 1600s at the time that they began the slave trade. By the way, the Hawkins started it, but the royal family took it over.
Oh, yeah. Well, the slave trading has been going on since the beginning of time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you've done great. 87 years old. I still can't get over it. That's amazing how... you've got your brains and everything about you, which is fantastic. So you,
thank you very
really,
much.
Really impressive there. Impressive stuff, man.
And I am so grateful that the murdered millions have had a voice here now today with you and me. We have spoken for them, and
yes.
Maybe justice will be done someday. The books will reflect reality. We're hoping for that. Thank you so very much.
The truth will out. The truth will out. This is an infodemic. It's not a plandemic. It's an infodemic. We got to use this time in history when we can speak and communicate and get information out. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I like to. I'm every day I learn something new. So this was quite revelatory. If that's a proper pronunciation, revelatory. So
yes, I'm going to remember. With you because I see you as one of the key people.
There are
a few, and you're certainly one of a very, very few, and I'm honored to know that you're there, and you give me hope.
Oh, good. Well, thank you so much. All right. Well, have a great night, and from Toronto to Chicago, have a good time, and I'll play us out with this wonderful music. I love this music. Have a good night.
Good night.